feels like evening, so maybe that would be appropriate. I'm Dan Decker, a professor and chair of the Department of Natural Resources. And for this afternoon, this evening's program, I'm going to serve as the MC, which means I've got to keep track of time and make sure the professors don't talk too long, that sort of thing. We're gathered here, of course, for this event to acknowledge the career and the generosity of Dr. Angela Bastille, a distinguished alumna from our department. She received both her bachelor's and her PhD in natural resources.
Hey, Dan?
Yeah.
Is there any chance of getting the mic up a little higher?
I don't know if it's on. I'll yell it.
Yell it out.
Yeah, I will. So I think we're going to hear a little bit about different kinds of interactions, either the people have had with me. And I had two I can remember that I'm going to start off with before I introduce our first really formal speaker. One was when I was an undergraduate student here about 1971. I had a class in wildlife conservation, which Neil probably recalls, and Ann was the guest speaker for that course. I remember it quite clearly because it was very rare that we had a female wildlife biologist speaking to our class in the early 1970s. So that was a memorable experience. My next interaction with Ann I can recall. The last example again was when I was department chair the first time through. I'm going through a second time, so I wanted to get it right this time. So anyway, well, the first time I was department chair about 20 years ago, and Ann came to made a visit on campus. I really don't recall who it was she was here to see exactly, but my formal job as department chair when she was here was to be a dog sitter.
Yes.
And I took care of two German Shepherds in my office. Well, she met with important people on campus, probably Milo and whatever. So that was my second experience with me. Of course, it's sort of several times after that, but it was sort of all my memories here. Of course, Anne passed away in 2011, but through her will, she remembered her alma mater, and she provided funding for the Woods Woman Scholarship Fund. And you've got materials here that you picked up, so I won't go into great detail on that, but the purpose of that fund is going to be to provide financial assistance for female graduate students in conservation and natural resources. So we're really pleased and honored that we have the role of sort of seeing that happen on her behalf, and administering that purpose. So it's really great, and we're here to sort of commemorate that a bit and kick it off. And with that, then, I'd like to sort of move to our next speaker, and that's Dr. Jim LeSoy. For those of you who don't know Jim's a longtime professor in the Department of Natural Resources, and he's had many kinds of roles here and kinds of service for the department, the college, and the university. One of those was also to be department chair once or twice. And I think that it's probably during that one of those periods, Jim, in the late 1980s, that he came to know and begin to work with Angela Bastille. So maybe share a few comments about those experiences.
Thank you, Dan. And folks, it's really great to see such a diverse group of people, and just it's a cross section, I think, of who Angela Bastille was, that you showed up today, and her influence on so many people for so many decades. And I think it's really a pleasure to be part of this program and to kind of acknowledge celebrate Anne's life and what contributions she made to conservation, to this department and its students and faculty, and to the college. I'm really thankful to have an opportunity to share just a few comments with you before we get into the real program and the real meat of that. It was interesting. I've got quite a thick file drawer full of information about Angela Bastille over the years I've worked with her. And I found in there a card, her calling card, and I found it quite interesting when I looked at it in reflection. It, of course, says West of the Wind Publications, Inc. Under it, Anne LaBastille, PhD, President. There's two German shepherds on the side, pictures. Westport address, and a phone fax number only. No email address. Now, and that you could contact her between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Underneath it says, ecological consulting, writing, lecturing, wilderness guiding. And I found that quite interesting, and what we'll do, I'm sure, the rest of the evening tonight when we share stories about Anne is to kind of unpack all of those things that was on her professional card. As Dan said, I kind of forget when I first met Anne, you know, which is not, she was certainly not forgettable, but you know, I think it reflects more the aging process and my interactions with Anne. I think he's right, it was in the late 80s when I was department chair and she showed up and I started to interactions that lasted, you know, for the next 25 years. Those were, you know, both on a personal level as well as a professional level, because Anne didn't really separate those two. And, you know, her professional life was really a big part of her personal life and vice versa. So it was very interesting. I was fortunate to spend a lot of time with her here on campus, at Ruth and my home in West Danby, where she often stayed, at her house in Westport, and then at Big Bear Lake at her cabin, you know, the one that she built in Woods Woman, the first book in 1976, which interestingly was the year I came here to campus, was her first book. I also helped a big part of it was Ruth and I had the opportunity to travel with Anne to Lake Atchalon and spend 10 days at the lake with her, going back to where she did her PhD work with her. And it was, you know, truly an amazing experience to be with Woods Woman and her, you know, where she had so many important things happen over so many years. I helped her put together a private foundation, a small NGO, and raised money to work back in at the lake, you know, specifically to help improve conservation on the lake for 4 or 5 years that ran, that we did quite a bit of work. I did some research work for Jaguar Totem, the book that she published in 1999. I did the research because I had access to the internet. Those of you know, Anne didn't really embrace computer technology and was amazed at how many things I could find from my computer while we were researching them. Also, I've helped her sponsor and come back to campus a number of times. I recall when she came back and gave the giant grebe story, which, you know, was very touching. It followed the extinction of the species on Lake Atchalon and her, where she did her research. There were also, any time when she published a new book, she was on campus for readings and signings, either here or at the bookstore. And she ran at least one or maybe two student writers workshops where she mentored for 2 days students in writing for popular outlets and all of that. So I want to wrap up by just telling a couple of stories that really identified identified Anne. First was Ruth Sherman, my wife, and I. We went up to Westport to visit Anne one summer, and we arrived about an hour after a torrential downpour, you know. And so we pulled into Anne's old farmhouse driveway, and Anne was out with her mud boots on, writing all of her corn plants that had been knocked over with, and putting a stick there. And so she was time, saw them, came over, we did the did the hug thing, and she walked onto the porch, and she sat down and pulled off her mud boots, and her toenails were painted.
Yes.
and it just, I don't know, I forgot, and it just struck me about, here's Woodswoman, you know, and that rustic elegance, you know, and class of someone who's not afraid to go out and dig in the mud and do all these kinds of things on that, but then took the care, you know, of a good pedicure and, you know, and all that. So, you know, that was a real defining moment. Second one was one of her short courses she did on writing. I had a student come the second day and complained. Okay, well, turned out he'd gone to a party that night and couldn't show up the next day, you know, because it started at promptly at 7:30 in the morning. And he complained about how kind of eccentric Anne was and how she demanded, what she demanded of writers. And he complained about that and talked to me for a few minutes as department chair about, you know, working with Anne LaBastille. And I said, well, what if you had the opportunity, you had the chance to spend 2 days with John Muir, Henry David Thoreau, Aldo Leopold, would you take that opportunity? Yeah, well, of course. And I said, well, do you think that they'd just be common, normal kinds of individuals, you know, and conventional kinds of professor kinds of people? And I think we communicated very well. and so, you know, I mean, we know what Anne did. She defined conservation in the Adirondacks. And I think nationally as well as internationally, but she also defined a place for women in wilderness and conservation. And after death, I had, there was some money left over in the foundation, not very much. You know, we never operated on very much. But it came to the university, came to the department, and so kind of in her spirit for the next, the last 3, 4, 5 years, whatever it's been, 3 or 4 years, I've been using that money to support women in conservation. You know, when a student came to the department and was going to a conference or something and was looking for money, that's where that kind of money went. We also funded a couple of males, I wasn't, but most of it went to women in conservation. So that's what we're going to talk about, and that's what we're going to hear about today, you know, all of that complex life that made up who we all knew as Anne LaBastille. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our next guest is Dr. Max Pfeffer, a professor in development sociology here, also senior associate dean in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. That means he's my boss. And he wants to share a few comments from the perspective of the college on and scholarship for contributions to the institution of the New York State.
Thanks, Dan. It's really nice to see everybody here, especially you, Dick. I'm really pleased to see you here tonight, really. And it's really nice. It's just great to be here. Everybody says, now Dan said this, Jim said this, this is not the real show, and I'll say the same thing again. I'm not going to take too much of your time. Leslie's going to provide the real talk here in a few minutes. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm here to bring warm regards from Dean Catherine Boer to all of you, and to on her behalf and on behalf of the entire faculty of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences to welcome you here this evening. We're really pleased to be able to pay tribute to Anne LaBastille for her scholarship, her service in public life, and also for her generosity in enabling us to establish the Woodswoman Scholarship Fund. So we're really grateful for that. The support and advancement of women through scholarship is something that's very close and very important to the university and to the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. The Woods Woman Scholarship Fund is going to be an important way for us to pursue our strategic objective in the college of creating greater diversity amongst in our students, faculty, and staff. So it's kind of central for our college. So it's really appropriate to pay tribute to Anne today. She was a leader in natural resources throughout her career, as Jim has already pointed out. And she was a good example of how someone can have great impact on many, many people through her scholarship, her writing and public service, and not to mention by setting an example and impacting the world. She had a great impact. Certainly here, we're grateful for those impacts. If nothing else, that it always reflected very favorably on Cornell. And as Dan mentioned, she has 2 degrees from here, and I think a very important alumna for all of us. She was a pathbreaker. Anne was a pathbreaker. She completed her PhD research in Guatemala. She studied the pipe-billed grebe and later advocated for its protection. Very important. One of the things I think that she wanted to do was prevent the extinction of that bird. That was one of the few things that she did not succeed at in her career. Now, the stories about meeting Anne, I was privileged to meet her. It was thanks to you. You probably don't remember this. Those are the kinds of things you're forgetting.
I'm sorry to forget how to open the doors.
I can help you with that. I'm not far behind you there. But I do remember this. It might be a fiction that, you know, I've kind of come up with things sometimes. But no, I really remember this. I remember meeting her, and it was a time when we had the Cornell Institute for Food, Agriculture, and Development, and we were kind of pushing into Central America to start some programming. We were involved in that. We brought her around, and then we talked about her work in Guatemala and the Tico and there and everything. And so that was, I remember that very, very well. And I remember at the time being struck by, look, this woman, we're just getting going here. She had already been doing this in the 1960s. And that she's already been working hard to make an impact. And she had been working on creating a habitat, protected habitat for that bird, and advocating for that, and succeeded in that, actually, creating a protected area there. I thought that was really important. Of course, her role as a commissioner in the Adirondack Park Agency had it was impressive to me, and I think it was really an important thing. And I think in general brings to the kind of the topic of her presence in the Adirondacks and how significant that was. And there's a few things I would note about that. One, I think I'm struck by the fact that she was working first in Lake Atitlan in Guatemala and with the Adirondack Park Agency. And I think one of the things that struck me about that is that she realized at an early stage that conservation was a global challenge. And I think in that way she was ahead of many environmentalists in the United States, already thinking kind of globally at that time. So that was one thing. Second, I think she put her knowledge and her values about nature to work in public service while she was commissioner. She did that for 17 years, I believe. So that was a very significant impact. And finally, her philosophy and personal experience with nature while living in the Adirondacks became an example for many, many people through the Woodswoman series, which Jim has already mentioned, which is very important. I think we have examples over here on the table. So she played a role at that time, I think, very significant as a public intellectual. You know, somebody out there reflecting, sharing that experience, and having an impact on people's lives. So that was another thing, I think. And I think I could go on here about her many, many contributions in different areas of scholarship and public life, but we could go on all afternoon. I won't do that. But I want to end here with the observation that Anne was a superb role model for many young people, especially women. That's what Jim was pointing out before. She was a scholar, she was a public intellectual, a public servant, and an activist in the conservation realm. And on top of that, she was a generous supporter of scholarship. So for all of these reasons, I think it's completely appropriate that we're paying tribute to Anne Lamastie this afternoon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Max. And as folks have alluded to, our next speaker is our featured speaker really tonight.
and that's Leslie Surprenant. Leslie's leader of the Invasive Species Coordination Unit in the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. And through that role, several of us here in the room know Leslie. We've had the opportunity to interact with her or work with her in the past. Leslie's also the executrix for in Lubbock Steel's State of Wolf, and she, in that capacity, she's been great help to us in setting up the Woods Woman Scholarship Fund. So that's been much appreciated. We really want to express that to Leslie for all that effort, and we know it was a lot of effort to do that. I think tonight we're going to give Leslie a few minutes to talk about Anne and her experiences, which I think we're going to learn, go back quite a way in Leslie's personal life and history. Maybe it's even transformational, that relationship. So would you join me in welcoming our guest?
Thank you. Thank you. So I did want to give folks a couple minutes. If you are sitting next to a chair that is empty, would you put your hand up so some of the folks here can get a chair? And then I'm going to try to do this without the microphone, but please, if you can't hear me, please speak up. And so, you know, Anne told me the reason she wore pink toenail polish was to cover her dirty toenails because she hardly ever wore shoes. Like, never wore shoes. So I didn't mean to start that I was going to start with a story, but other folks started with the first time they met Anne. My first recollection of having met Anne was I was on a snowmobile trip, and I was too young to drive a snowmobile on the road. We'd been in the woods, and I was driving in the woods, and then we got out to a road, and we're up by on the Stillwater Road in the Western Adirondacks, and then my grandmother had to drive. Well, we hit a patch of ice, and the first thing my grandmother did was slam on the brakes, and we spun around and had a big snowmobile wreck and broke the windshield on our snowmobile, and so it was mighty cold, as it is in the, you know, as it is now, but colder than now. And we had to make our way the rest of the trip with no windshield. And if you ever snowmobiled with no windshield, it's no fun. And so I would say 9 or 10 years old. We get out to an intersection, and there's Anne LaBastille in her pickup truck. And she never, by the way, she never drove a car. I never saw her drive a car in my life. It was always a pickup truck. And so then she had this big dog that was that dog right there, Peetsy. And she saw this, you know, freezing cold kid. She said, "You get in my truck right now. It's nice and warm. And you cuddle up to that big dog. He is not going to hurt you." So that was my first recollection of meeting Anne. So I guess I, to advance a slide, so I think I can do this. So for those of you who knew who she was, I think you've gotten a pretty good background. She was truly a trailbreaker. For those of you who knew her, I think you're going to learn a lot more tonight. And for those of you who never knew her or knew of her, you're going to learn about an amazing woman. She wrote over a dozen popular books, including the Woods Woman series and Ecology series, over 150 popular articles, and over 25 scientific articles. So, Anne was born Mariette LaBastille. She hated that name, and when I first knew her, she told me, "Don't you ever tell anybody that's my name." And so it was our secret, but when her best friend wrote her obituary, it came out. So now I can say that her name was Maria Anne LaBastille, and she greeted the world November 20th, 1933, and she was a single child. She was born in New York City. She grew up in Montclair, New Jersey. And I'm going to spend some time talking about her parents and about the interesting family background that she comes from. But both of her parents came from rather large families. And they were, the one characteristic that goes, or the several characteristics that go through both of those families is that they were very accomplished. There were a lot of eccentrics. There were engineers, architects, intellectuals, and a treasure hunter. It was a real heritage of intellect, hard work, persistence, and just really kind of oddball characters. And follow, you're going to find some common threads as I carry you through this biography of Anne. And I'm going to talk about her heritage and some common threads, and I think it's going to give you some insight into how she became the person that she was. So this is her mom and dad and her as a little baby. on her father's side of the family was Sir William Phipps. He was born in Maine in 1650. He became a treasure hunter in the West Indies, and it was funded by the British monarchy. He discovered a sunken treasure. It was the largest Spanish galleon ever, and it was loaded with thousands and thousands of pieces of 25-carat gold, 22 and a half carat gold. And in 1600s dollars, he recovered over $3 million in treasure, and that was 1600s dollars. So he had made this bargain with the monarchy of Britain, and he paid their cut, and he became really famous and really rich all of a sudden. And he was honored. The king appointed him to be the first governor of Massachusetts. He was knighted by the king, and it turned out that he was a much better treasure hunter than he was politician. He got into all sorts of controversies. He actually set up he was in power when the Salem witch trials came. He set them up. He saw them running amok. He shut them down. Nonetheless, he created so much chaos, he was called back to England for corruption. But Anne was very proud that this man's blood ran in her veins. Jumping ahead about 200 years, on Anne's mother's side, this is Anne's grandfather on her mother's side, Julius Goebel. He was her grandfather, and he was quite a character. He came to America when he was 15 years old with his parents. After the Austro-Prussian War, his family was not going to swear allegiance to a king. He had a PhD. He was a professor in German studies, and he was among the earliest professors at Stanford University when Stanford first started, but he was very proud of his German ancestry, and he tramped through the hills of Germany with a zither, you know, a musical instrument under his arm, and he collected folk tales and folk music throughout Germany, and he was really passionate about ethics and about philosophy and really passionate about German culture, and he wanted to make sure German culture stayed in America, remained in America. So he was really ethical. He had these super high academic standards, and he was a firebrand, and he was hated by his adversaries, and he was adored by his admirers, much like Anne. So he arrives at Stanford University early on, but he realizes that he gets really critical of the university. He said there's no original research, very little, there's internal spying. And he just said, you know, this is all substandard. And somewhere in the meantime, Mr. Stanford died, and so his wife Jane was the one left. It was started by Leland and Jane Stanford. And so Leland dies, and so the head of the college, Dave Jordan was his name, hated Julius Goebel. And so Jane Stanford made David Jordan invite Julius Goebel to a fancy faculty dinner. And he did it, but he was plenty unhappy about doing it. And a couple weeks later, Mrs. Stanford tastes something pretty funny in her water. And she was convinced she was being poisoned. So she hastens away on vacation to Hawaii. And of course, she's in California, so it's not that far. But hasten in those days meant a freighter boat. So she goes by freighter boat to Hawaii, and she did die there a few weeks later, and the coroner did rule it strychnine poisoning. So David Jordan hastens to Hawaii again on a freighter, and he brings somebody with him, and together they issued a press release that said, Jane Stanford died of natural causes. And then he hastens his way back to California and promptly fired Julius Goebel, and it created international protests. It was a really big deal, and it was all about academic freedoms, and it stands to this day as one of a couple of cases that are studied about academic freedoms. It was very, very difficult for Julius Goebel to get another job. He worked a little bit at Harvard, and while he was trying to get a job at Harvard, the big earthquake hit in California, and I actually have come across the letter from Anne's grandmother writing to Dear Julius, my beloved, this is awful. I have the kids living up on the tennis court, the house we can't go into, so it's this real heart-rendering letter. So in any case, he had a really hard time getting a job, and it took Teddy Roosevelt intervened to get him a job, and he ended up at Illinois State University. Anne's parents, Ferdinand LaBastille and Irma Goebel, also known as Kate Thornhill, and I'll tell you why, and she's Kate in a minute, but Ferdinand, he had five siblings, and all except for one was born in Haiti. He was born in Haiti, and a lot of these folks, they immigrated to the United States and Brazil, and they were engineers and architects and that, and his brother started Brazil's largest airline, so they're really, you know, like this real, you know, German engineering, German intellect kind of a family. Ferdinand became a citizen in 1921, and he had his bachelor's degree from Illinois State University and his master's degree from Columbia. He was also a professor in German studies, and he was described by one of Anne's cousins as a sweet, cultured, very, you know, refined and gentle man. Irma, her mom, she had a big family. She had six siblings, and they were all educated at the Illinois State University. She became a famous concert pianist, and I think that's about all Anne ever told me about her mom, is she was a famous concert pianist and the only woman stevedore in the United States. So she was a lecturer and a performer, and I'm going to talk more on her a little bit later, but her siblings, they were very accomplished as well. Uncle Julius, her brother, became a legal scholar and historian at Columbia University. Her brother, Uncle Walter, became a biochemist at Rockefeller University, and he was known for his research on polysaccharides. And her sister, Aunt Marie, became a historian and biographer of Thomas Jefferson. So Irma was born in California, like I said. She could speak five languages by the time she was eight. She studied music at Illinois State University and then University of Berlin in Germany. She was a renowned pianist throughout Europe and the United States. And she also researched rare folklore stories throughout Latin America and Central America. And she did that for 25 years. And remember, her father did the same thing in Germany. Now she's doing it in Latin America and Central America. She's collecting folk stories. She's collecting folk songs. She's collecting and purchasing period attire. And she would come back to the United States, and she would do these. I forgot to switch slides. She would do a lot of concerts and performances. And she and Ferdinand wanted to bring Central American and South American culture to North America and have sort of a One America look through culture. And so they're bringing the music of that part of the world here and thinking that, you know, we can unify people through culture. She was a famous Latin American folk singer. She also wrote for the New York Times and the London Times. So she was quite a character. Ferdinand was not quite as flamboyant, but he was among his jobs. And when he was, as Anne was growing up, he taught at Columbia University, New York University, and several colleges in New Jersey. So Anne was a young world traveler. And when she was 5 years old, her parents took her on a freighter to Central America, and it was called the Santa Lucia freighter. And the purpose of the trip was for her mom to research music again in Central America. And this one opportunity they had, this to go ashore, the boat couldn't make it ashore. There was no good wharf there, and there was really choppy, stormy water. And the only way to get ashore was to get into a chair and be lowered over the edge by a boom. And Anne's mom said to her, "Come on, honey, this will be fun. Let's do it." And so Anne and her mom did it, and they were the only people on the whole boat that did that. So they did it. So the earliest writing that I found from Anne, she was writing about this trip. She's 6 years old, and so I'm going to read you this excerpt that I found. This is, "Every evening, Mommy fixed my hair like Snow White and let me wear one of my best dresses for dinner. I wore my party shoes every night, too. In the afternoons, Mommy let me have a bottle of Coca-Cola. That was delicious. I love Coca-Cola so much. The first place that Santa Lucia stopped was Panama. Before we left home, my kindergarten teacher gave me a pair of dark glasses that fit me just right. And I had to wear them all the time in Panama because the sunshine was so bright that I had to squint. Daddy bought me a brown belt made out of an alligator. He said we might see an alligator, and that sometimes they bite people like bad dogs, only harder. So if you knew Anne, you knew she loved Coca-Cola to her dying day, and that would certainly not be her last trip to Panama. Anne grew up in Montclair, New Jersey, playing under trees in her yard. She really yearned for adventure, and she would ask her parents for stout boots and a BB gun, and she would get ballet shoes and stockings. She wanted to be an Indian, and she would climb up this pine tree. I think it's over to the right in the picture. She would climb up this pine tree at night, and she would look and avert her eyes from the lights of New York City and look towards the darkness of the New Jersey Pine Barrens and really yearn to be out there in the countryside. And she even climbed that tree as a late teenager. She attended private girls' school in high school, regular public school, and up to, I think, about eighth grade. Her parents divorced when she was 16 years old. And she stayed behind, and she finished her senior year at the Kimberly School for Girls. And after her senior year, her mom wanted her to come down. Her mom, after her parents divorced, her mom moved down to Miami. And she writes this to her mom. You know, her mom's asking her to come down to Miami, and she writes this. I run across, and never threw anything away. So she said, in this letter I ran across, "I'd like to come down if I can go camping in the Everglades, really dive for treasure, wear shorts and dungarees and not have to be fancy. Could I really dive? If I find treasure, can I keep it?" So she's really, like, she's all about treasure hunting. And then I actually ran across, she actually bought stock in a treasure hunting company in Miami. She bought $10 in stock. And I looked it up, the company's actually still in business. So she was serious about this treasure hunting. So here's more about Kate Thornhill. Her mom, when she went to Miami, she wanted to start a whole new life. And she took it to, you know, almost to extremes, I think. She changed her name to Kate Thornhill, Kate in honor of her mother. And she started her own business shipping livestock and racehorses, but that was one of the only not the only thing she did. She then became the only woman stevedore on the docks in the whole country, but she was on the docks of Miami as a contract stevedore. And if this is a term you're not familiar with, I don't want to insult anybody, but they work under a contract and they boss the dock hands around to load and unload boats on the docks. And she brought her training and language to good use because she could swear at those guys in a whole bunch of different languages. And many of them were Cuban workers, and when they were lagging too much, she would yell at them, "Viva Cuba!" And they would just work like crazy. So like Anne, she was an environmentalist, and she spearheaded a cleanup of the Miami River, which caused her a lot of grief, tire slashing and death threats and just, you know, general little things like that. She learned to operate a tugboat, and that's how she earned the nickname Tugboat Kate. And she was described as really wacky, flamboyant, just really kind of out there. But again, you know, like I said, she wanted these jobs that were so different from anything else that she ever did. She took a job taking care of reptiles, and she would bring them to TV shows. And there'd be like these TV shows that, you know, with these exotic animals. And they would have to go in the middle of the night. There were snakes and reptiles and all this. So one of the jobs that they had to do, they had to feed 600 baby alligators. And they had to do it in the middle of the night. But her mom was kind of a socialite, and so she would be sometimes in evening attire having entertained some international guest or something. And then she and Anne in their fancy clothes would go in the lab and feed the 600 baby alligators. So there was a real contrast, though. Her mom, Anne's mom, Irma, was really adventurous and brave. And I think you could say she really was outside of the typical female mold for the 1950s and early 1960s. She did not let Anne drive until she was 19. If you ever saw how Anne drove, that was a really good thing, but it wasn't for that reason. She never let Anne camp out, and she would always tell Anne, girls don't wear pants, girls don't camp out, girls don't this, girls don't that. And yet she was living the, you know, outside the box life as, you know, a stevedore and a tugboat operator, and, you know, you name it, she was out there doing it. So Anne and her mom had a, you know, bit of a difficult life. I think what we see here are two very strong-willed and independent women. But Anne was really shy and quiet, and her mom was really flamboyant and outgoing. And they had, you know, a difficult relationship. And so I'm sure without even the picture says it all, her mom had this Carmen Miranda get-up, and I'm sure she got Anne to put it on, and you see how happy Anne is about this. So Anne had... There was only one woman Anne knew about that was had an outdoor nature type job, and that was Dr. Eugenie Clark. She had written a popular book called Woman with a Spear. She was a marine biologist, and she was doing research on sharks and poisonous fishes for the U.S. Navy, and she was also a researcher at a Woods Hole Institute in Massachusetts. So she was a role model for Anne and the only one that she had at the time. Excuse me, I'm just going to grab a swig. This is my hillbilly bottle here. Grab a swig hillbilly style. Is that the one? Yes. So Anne was indeed a trailbreaker, and you've heard that tonight. Here at Cornell, she got her bachelor's. She loved the field work. She loved the chainsaw. She loved, you know, the transits and the trap lines. And then it comes time to senior research project, and she is told, the professor she had at the time told her, you have to do library or museum work. Well, she refused. That was BS. She didn't want any part of that, and she had to fight to do field work. And then the professor then told her she was going to become an erotic old maid. And then there was a complaint here. There was a complaint at this fine university that this blonde-haired, you know, woman with the pigtails ran around with a pack basket and bare feet, and how could you possibly let her do that? And apparently the dean at the time said, she gets straight A's. She's interested. What's your problem? You know? So when it came time to get jobs, the only jobs she could find were office work, and she kept getting told, no, you're a woman. No outdoor work for you. She was really passionate about having an outdoor career. And she got her bachelor's here in 1955. So this is, you know, almost 60 years ago. So a lot has changed in that time. But she watched her male friends and students go off to become forest rangers and wardens. And the only job she could get was behind a desk in Florida, you know, talking to people about where they could go, where some guy could take them on a hike. So she, I found a diary, and her diary entry was, her life's fight was going to be for her and other women to be allowed to have outdoor careers. And she would either fight and win or die failing in the fight. So she was that passionate. I also found, scratched out, her first will. It was notes in this very diary, and it said her final wish was for her Audubon supervisor to hire the first female tour operator. The next summer, she became Audubon Society's first female tour operator. Now, of course, they made her wear skirts, a hat, fancy shoes, and she begged them and cajoled them. And if you knew Anne, she could beg and cajole until she would just wear you down and finally just say, okay. So she cajoled them for weeks. So they finally allowed her to wear pants and flat shoes. And so she did, and here is a picture of her in the, I'm going to say, late 50s, with the National Audubon Society station wagon, and she's doing work in Florida. She led tours of the Everglades and some in the Florida Keys and some parks down in Florida. So she was there. That was her first conservation job that she was allowed to be outdoors. And she applied to all conservation organizations in the country, and she was allowed one job, and it was non-paying, and it was in Wyoming. So, in fact, the first, and then she had started writing, and in fact, the very first outdoor articles that she tried to get written kept getting rejected because she would put them in and La Bastille. She finally put in an article under Al. Actually, it was Anne La Bastille or Al Bowes. She put one in. That was her married name a little bit later. And I actually have it open here. You can actually see for your very own eyes that she had to publish under a man's name in order to get published in an outdoor magazine. So I think there's a lot of contrast from there to today. She was only the second female natural resource student here at Cornell. When I went to school, I graduated from college in 1981, about 20% of us were women, and I think the statistic now is 50% or more of the students in natural resources are female. So, you know, we've come a long way in about 80 years, or 60 years. Adirondacks, marriage, and hard work. When Anne was working in Florida, she met and fell in love with Major Claude Vernon Bowes. He was 14 years her senior, so she went and lived in the Adirondacks. First, he invited her to come work at his place in the Adirondacks, Covewood Lodge, near Big Moose. And he said, do you want to work in the kitchen? No. Do you want to wait table? No. Do you want to, do chambermaid? No. And he goes, okay, do you want to tend the horses? Yes. She was all over it. So here's an early picture of her at Covewood Lodge, all gussied up, you know, taking care of the horses. And then in the lower right-hand corner, her husband and her, and then a brochure that was for Adirondack Life or Adirondack Covewood Lodge. So it was hard work. She married in 1956, and her husband encouraged her to go back to college to get her master's degree. He was really supportive of her doing that. So she did go back to college. And she went to Colorado State University, and she got her master's in 1961. But before that happened, she applied to 12 universities for a master's program. And in virtually all instances, women were confined to literature searches only. Literature searches only. No field work. No field work. Only Colorado would allow field work. So she got a scholarship at Colorado, offered a scholarship at Colorado State. Because she insisted on doing field work, they rescinded the scholarship. And she said, you could take your damn scholarship. I'm doing field work. So she did field work. And she, it was the ecological analysis of Mule Deer Range, Kashla Pruder Canyon in Colorado. And in 1987, she took me with her to a World Wilderness Conference. And she took me to where she did her field work, and I could just really sense the pride that she had in the work that she did. And so, you know, she really wanted me to see that. She and her husband led, at the same time she's working on her bachelor or her master's degree, they're running this inn in the summertime. She and her husband ran the first eco tours out of the United States. They bought a 57-foot boat called the Snowbird, and it was based out of Miami. And they lived on that boat in the winters sometimes. And they would take a lot of the same people that were coming to their lodge in the summertime were going on these tours through Latin America and the Caribbean in the wintertime. And it was there were no breaks from the tourists year round, and it was really tough. And working on her master's, but she did. She and her husband are credited with leading the first ecotourism. And now, of course, ecotourism is quite a big thing. Here's a picture of back from the 50s, the ecotours. One of them. So life was tough for her and her husband with all of the demands. And she had started writing, and she really, really yearned to write. And she was able to sequester herself away on Sunday afternoons and write. But it just became too much. And they did end up getting divorced. And the year between 1964 and 1965 were very difficult for her. Her father died. She divorced. But this was also an opportunity. She had long dreamed of building herself a Thoreau-type cabin. And she found property on a lake in the western Adirondacks that had no road to it, no electricity, no running water. And she, with help, built a log cabin, and she broke ground in May 1964 and moved in on July 4th, which was, if you know Henry David Thoreau, that's the day he moved in his Thoreau cabin in Concord. So she cut no logs from her own land. She was this real purist. She actually had logs brought in and floated down the lake and hoisted up and made into the cabin. But it never had running water or she had some funky little system where she could pump water up to a stock tank and it ran down, but it didn't last very long. It broke down and that was that. So she never had electricity, running water, or plumbing. She did finally, when she first got there, there were no phone lines. She did get a telephone put in there when lines came through. Otherwise, it was a citizen band radio. She failed to read the fine print on her deed, and in fact, she built the cabin too close to the water. And October of that year, it had to be moved back 30 feet. And it, if you read Woodswoman, she tells about that, but they moved back on greased logs. So, and then she took this opportunity to return to Cornell for her PhD, and there was a bird in Lake Atitlan that just called to her. She and her husband had seen it when they were in Guatemala and had inquired a little bit about it and found out that this giant flightless grebe of Guatemala had never really been studied. So she did move into her cabin, and so one of the treasures I found is her actual cabin log, and I'm going to have this here. It's actually, I don't know if anybody here ever went up there birding or anything, but there's lists of birds that people wrote down. So this goes from 1964 when she broke ground to the 1980s, and there's a lot of pictures, but I'm going to just read a little something. And if you ever read Woodswoman and you look at some of the excerpts in here, you see it just gets taken right into Woodswoman. So this is her, and this is written November 29th, 1964. There's a strong east wind. It melts the ice again with rain. A symphony is playing between the rain, the wind, and the temperature to see who will bring the silence to the water's music or who will permit it to play just a little longer. Back and forth, back and forth. Meanwhile, we humans switch from boat to trail with sighs. A harder life, yet rewarding in its own way. It's fundamental. Your back and the strength in your legs and the wind now dictate what you wear, eat, and carry. So it's a nice little treasure from her cabin. So she split her time. A lot of folks think that she lived in that cabin year-round. In fact, she did not. She stayed until Christmas time the first year, and she would stay into the winter time, and she would check on it in the winter, but she never lived in that cabin year-round. She split her time between travels and her research work in Guatemala. So here she wrote Woodswoman about living in the cabin, but that was that's her in her cabin with her manual typewriter. She never used an electric typewriter and couldn't abide the idea of touching a computer. So she did everything. She would handwrite. She had all these yellow legal-sized pads, handwrite every manuscript, and she never threw anything away, so there's tons of manuscripts, all handwritten and then scribbled out, and then the next one was typed. So, you know, you get a few handwritten manuscripts and a few typed ones. So she studied the giant grebe of Lake Atitlan. It was flightless. It was only at Lake Atitlan. And she, it was in severe decline, and it had not been researched, had never been photographed, and its life history had not been described. So she and her husband, when they were there, had done a quick census on it, and that was it. So she returned back to work on that project. Should have known that she would be an ornithologist, a picture of her with a little stuffed bird when she's, 5 years old, and with an emaciated juvenile grebe in Guatemala. So she conducted this research, and she got established the first wildlife preserve. And so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but she worked really closely engaging the local people and worked at all levels of the government, just across the board. They investigated habitat issues as to why this bird was failing, and they conducted education and outreach. They did an annual census, and the focus with the local people in Guatemala was not on preserving a bird for bird's sake, but on national pride and tourism. And I think those are lessons that we, will have today as well. One of the projects that happened was there were paintings that were commissioned, and these are not the paintings that were commissioned by the government, but the paintings were commissioned by the government, and they were used to make postage stamps. And I actually have commemorative bird postage stamps here that were made from the paintings. They were, to date, the most successful, what do you call those, kind of special stamps in Guatemala ever. So those are pictures of the stamps. So Anne's working on her PhD thesis, but she darn nearly quit the PhD program because she couldn't stand it, needed 1 year of residence. She'd been, you know, so free in her travels and stuff. And so she was here in Cornell. She was lonely. She hated the dorm life. And she was just, you know, this close to quitting that PhD program. And this kind professor realized that she was in crisis and she needed to be talked to. So he cancels his meetings, pulls her in, and he said, Anne, your PhD is going to be your ticket to the future. It's going to give you respect and credibility. Take a year off and come back. And so she did just that. She went straight away to Guatemala, 5 years to do her PhD research. 5 years later, she had her PhD, and she had spearheaded Guatemala's first wildlife preserve. It was, and then from there on, it was 25 years of passion, hard work, and commitment. Unfortunately, that bird did become extinct, and there were a lot of factors, socioeconomic and natural factors, and probably the last and final nail in the coffin was an earthquake that opened up cracks in the bottom of Lake Atitlan, drained water. The water level fell so fast, and the reed habitat went away. They're really dependent on reed habitat, but there's the whole development, civil war, habitat destruction, invasive species, and then natural forces. So she did write a book called Mama Pock, and that was, it's probably the only known 25-year study and full investigation of a bird that became extinct. So you heard Jim Lassoy mention an NGO in about 2000. Anne and some others started a new NGO. It was called Save Atitlan. And it lasted a few years, and it was aimed at habitat restoration, you know, because the grebe is gone, but there's still stuff that could be done. Stabilizing slopes, planting native species, addressing raw sewage, and then reaching out to and talking with the Mayan women who wash their clothes in the water of the lake right next to raw sewage. So it was to train healthcare workers. And I think you'll recognize a familiar face. There's a Dr. Lassoy with Ruth and Anne up there in that picture. Professor LaBastille, she became Cornell's first female natural resource professor. She taught for 2 years, and I ran across some film, and I had negatives printed up. It turns out she took a bunch of pictures of her students, so maybe somebody will recognize those students. She taught just for those 2 years, and she realized that academia wasn't for her. And so she then really, truly learned the value of her PhD. She started international environmental consulting. And one of the first jobs she did, she gets dropped on a beach in Anadaga, British Virgin Islands. And she has to find water. She's dropped with no water and a grad student. And she's supposed to do the first biological survey. But she did a lot of the very first environmental, you know, biological surveys, environmental surveys of parks that were proposed in Panama, Dominican Republic, British Virgin Islands, and the Amazon. And that's a picture from early on, slash and burn in the Amazon. This book, Jaguar Totem, chronicles her various adventures in environmental consulting and field work. And she would sometimes serve as the guest lecturer on these ecological cruises. In 1993, she was a staff ecologist on the MS Polaris Special Expedition to Panama. And she sees a Chaco Indian woman painting another woman. She decides, you know, do that to me too. So she gets this on, and then she zooms back, and she gets on the boat. Just the tides drop, and she runs out, gets on the boat, and I think the next night was the last night on this boat, and she's got this paint on her face, and there's the fancy dinner, you know, that they have always on these boats, and she tried all kinds of hazardous chemicals to get that thing off her face. And so then she, in exasperation, she goes to the ship's library. She looks this stuff up. It's something called Genipa Americana tree, and it says it cannot be removed. It lasts 10 days. Well, so then she goes to this fancy thing, all dressed up in a white dress, fancy shoes, a hair all up in her tiger face. So then she comes home. You know, she comes home. It lasted 3 weeks, and she on her face the whole time that she has many layovers and flights back from Panama through, you know, landing at Albany Airport and all that. So she's got this stuff on for 3 weeks. She was an author, as you know, I mean, 12 books, starting with Woods Woman is probably the most popular, but she had quite a number of books, and I'll just call out one of them. She, as again, you know, manual typewriter, handwritten notes, never electric, and In the Steps of Her Grandfather, Julius Goebel, she collected folk tales of the Maya, and she writes Birds of the Maya. And this is songs and folk tales of the Maya, plus the birds that are down there, in the Mayan, in primarily Guatemala, Central America, and then tells about, the folk tales are about the birds that are in here. So there's that thread. Remember, there's that thread that keeps going through, which is storytelling and collecting folk tales. She became Adirondack Park Agency Commissioner. She was the first person ever to be a commissioner at APA with a science background. She truly introduced science to decision-making in the Adirondacks, and she initiated the Ecology Committee. She was there for, 18 years, it looks like, 17, 18 years. Unfortunately, in the mid-90s, there was the Adirondack equivalent of the Sagebrush Rebellion. There was this huge property rights movement. There were log trucks that were slowing down traffic on the Northway, et cetera, et cetera. And there were threats and arson, death threats. She got death threats. There was graffiti and vandalism on, I think it was the Adirondack Council's office and another office happened. I think something happened to APA. Well, somebody burned down her barn. In the meantime, she had about 1988, 1989, she'd bought a farm in Westport because it gave her a nice home base. She could work there. She was close to Adirondack. She wasn't too far from Albany. So she had this really nice farm with a beautiful barn, and she had electricity and running water, all the things that, you know, civilized people have and what she really needed to be doing her work. And somebody came and burned her barn, and she was so badly shaken that I never heard her, and I don't think she did. She never could risk being as outspoken and as much of an advocate as she was before then. She just couldn't risk it because she got death threats and somebody burned her barn. So, you know, so 1992 was about the last that she really was, you know, out there. It didn't mean that she didn't continue to make contributions. She very much did, but she wasn't as, you know, she didn't dare to be as outspoken as she was. So it was really, you know, kind of a tragedy. She was a charter member of the newly revamped New York State Guides Association. She was a guide. She and I co-instructed for a couple years at Sagamore in Racket Lake, the Women in Wilderness, or the Wilderness Women Weekend. That's a picture of her and me by a woodpile. And I got a job just out of college as a wilderness ranger. And Ann and I had been, you know, I knew her. We'd been communicating back and forth, but she heard that I was doing that job, and she actually, that fall, she reaches out to me when she's done, gets back in town, she's done with her field work, and she said, you know, most of the time people are talking about what I'm doing, now everybody's talking about what you're doing, it's time we got to know each other better. So she invited me to spend a weekend with her, help her catch up on stuff, and so we became good friends. And she wanted to join me as a wilderness, you know, when I was doing my patrol, I was by myself patrolling a 50,000-acre wilderness in the Adirondacks. And so it was so much fun. We were this real study in contrast. So here we were. She would hike with her bare feet and her painted toenails, and I had hiking boots. She had these ratty jeans or ratty cutoffs and no shirt, but it was a pink or a leopard bra. I had this sharp, you know, uniform with fancy patches. She took, you know, those like egg crate roll-up mats. She would take one of those, roll it all up, and tie it to her pack, and it would just flop along. And I had this really tight, you know, closed cell foam, and it was on top, and it was in its own little case. It was all really tight. So she'd have this thing flopping along. She had her camera dangling from her pack, and it was just bang, bang, bang all the time. And then we get to the to camping, and I'd whip out my little backpack and stove and get it going. She'd, you know, make her wood fire. And so she always kidded me about, you know, using non-renewable resources, and I'd just kid her about having to walk a lot further to get her fuel. So, you know, we just had a lot of fun. And one time we were camping in the Moose River Plains, and we were working on her Ponds of the Plains article, getting pictures and things. And she was, as usual, driving faster than she could. And if you ever got a letter from her, it was all like jiggity. I said, what's up with that? You know, she has bad handwriting anyway. Oh, I write all my letters while I'm driving. That's the only time I have time. So she's a bad driver anyway. We're flying through the Moose River Plains. It's this dirt road. We go around this bend, and there's a campsite on the bend, and we go peel it almost right through their campsite. There's these two guys, and they just, like, get their huge eyes, and they back up and run away. And then she turns around, she looks at me, she passes, did I scare you, dear? Like, so we had a lot of fun and mutual respect. Anne had a guiding mentor. His name was Bob Burkhart. And she would spend at least one day a week hiking, and he showed her all around her piece of the Adirondacks. And I found, just last week actually, I found a picture of her, 1959, 1960. She's a guide in training, and that's her out in the Independence River country. She won a number of awards for conservation literature, many awards, and she was particularly proud of the World Wildlife Fund award. She won the gold medal in 1974 for Conservationist of the Year by the World Wildlife Fund. And she was really, really proud of the Roger Torrey Peterson Award for National Educator. I have, and you are welcome to come and look at it, I have her gold medal from the World Wildlife Fund. And she won this gold medal and a Rolex watch. And I have a gold medal from the Society for Women Geographers. But so you, I will have these with me, and you can come and see them afterwards. So all this notoriety, people really figured out where she was. And this was before the days of GPS and all that. So she wrote Woodswoman, and men fall in love with her, and women fall in love with her, and everybody's trying to find her. And, you know, so she left enough clues that if you put together a bunch of topo maps, you might be able to figure it out. So people did figure it out, and she started getting uninvited company and, like, bottles of wine left on her dock and all this and that. So she, her admirers sort of went to extremes to find her, and, you know, she is a very private person. So there were more camps and more boats on Black Bear Lake. And so she pushed to the back of her property, and she built this for less than $200. She builds this Thoreau 2, and this is on the backside. It's a half-mile nasty bushwhack, and by the time you get there, it feels like you walk 5 miles. So she builds that to make herself a little writing retreat. And this was her right-hand man, Rodney. He's well into his 80s when he's helping her, but he helped her a lot, and he, you know, there he is with the chainsaw, so that's Mr. Rodney. Good, just really old-time guide, just nice. So I'm just going to flash through a bunch of slides just so you can enjoy them, sort of Anne at home and her cabin, pictures from her cabin. This is her farm at Westport. Her farm at Westport, you see what happened to the barn before and after. This picture I love, it's her young in the canoe. And then if you look, you can see in the picture on the right, she's about 74 years old. She has just the same smile and the same young face. It's maybe about 3 years before she died in a guide boat. And she didn't do all this by herself. She had the help of friends. And the guy on the left is John Miller from across the lake, and the guy on the right is my beloved dad. That's Anne and me out on the ice checking her cabin. And Anne had a lifelong love of dogs, and she was absolutely leader of the pack. So she finally did get a cat. So Anne did become ill, and she did need long-term care. And her last dog was Krispy Kreme. And so when Anne went into long-term care, I remembered that Anne had asked me about 25 years before, if anything should ever happen to her, would I take whatever dog she had at the time? And I said yes to her. Well, when I found out that she had to go into long-term care, I couldn't just do this. So I went home, and we talked it over at dinner that night. And some folks know that we have an adopted little girl. And when I told the story at dinner table, our little girl said, "You gave me a forever home. Krispy Kreme needs a forever home. We need to do this." So Krispy Kreme now lives with us. And this is our daughter. And with our two dogs, Krispy Kreme is the German Shepherd. And Krispy Kreme does have a good life. She went backpacking a couple times with us. So that we became Krispy Kreme's new forever home. And we would take Krispy up to CN, up in Lake Plattsburgh. And when Anne died, we had a two-day sort of drop-in memorial service at the lake where her cabin is. And she had a vision, and it was to preserve her cabin and her property as forever wild, where she found inspiration in the Adirondacks. It was to establish a writer's retreat, and it was to she wanted a new nonprofit started, and she wanted, obviously, this Woodsman Scholarship at Cornell. So it became my job to deliver her wishes. And so there were some easy, simple ones, which were small gifts. And then there were some that weren't so easy and simple. And so I'm going to share with you the LaBastille Legacy Projects. And I have to, at this time, really say thank you to Cornell, because I would not be able to do the legacy projects that I'm describing on Anne's behalf if Cornell University did not agree to waive a little bit of the funding that it would have gotten otherwise. So thank you, Cornell. You're allowing me to do the whole package. So I started a Memorial Writers Residency. It's a partnership with the Community Foundation of Herkimer and Oneida County and the Adirondack Center for Writing. It's funded $300,000 endowment. The first Adirondack, the first writer's residency was held early last month. It was a huge success. They had a competitive process, 80-some-odd applicants, six people got slots. It was held at a restored lodge right on the lake where her cabin is, which is Twitchell Lake. That's a picture of the writers. There were six of them won their slots around the fireplace at her cabin, and then a picture of one of the recipients. Her cabin is going to the Adirondack Museum. This week was scheduled to start deconstruction of her cabin. So the cabin and a $300,000 endowment go to the Adirondack Museum. The Adirondack Museum is engaged in a wholesale revisioning of what they are, and they're going to be completely redoing their exhibits, and they're super excited about this acquisition, and it's going to be a focal point of their new what they're calling the Adirondack Experience. So that's all going to be in place by the end of 2017. And the work, her cabin's going to be dismantled this fall, and the logs skidded down the ice, and I expect that it's probably going to be rebuilt before 2017. A land donation, her property is, and this is the first time this is being announced publicly, I've arranged to donate her property to New York State. She wanted it to be forever wild, and it will be annexed to the Pigeon Lake Wilderness Area. So this is actually looking from her Thoreau 2 cabin actually into the Pigeon Lake Wilderness Area. Her property butts right up onto Pigeon Lake Wilderness Area. So it will remain exactly what she wanted, which is forever wild. And, of course, we have our Woodswoman Scholarship. So Anne would have been 81 tomorrow. Tomorrow would be her birthday. Oh, sorry about that. So I just wanted to, Anne, in her wishes, she had, she said any tribute that she had certain things that wanted to be read. So if you will indulge me a moment, I'll just read a poem that she wanted. It's Barter by Sarah Truesdale. Life has loveliness to sell, all beautiful and splendid things. Blue waves, whitened on a cliff, soaring fire that sways and sings, and children's faces looking up, holding wonder like a cup. Life has loveliness to sell, music like the curve of gold, scent of the pines in the rain, eyes that love you and arms that hold. And for your spirit's still delight, holy thoughts that start the night. Spend all you have for loveliness. Buy it and never count the cost. For one white singing hour of peace, count for many a year of strife well lost. And for a breath of ecstasy, give all you have been or could be. And so I think the legacy will continue. This young lady, my daughter, chose Woodswoman as her backpack reading material. So I would like to invite, I think John Fitzpatrick is here. Is John? Yeah, come up, sir. Can you? So John Fitzpatrick is the director of the Lab of Ornithology. I haven't had the opportunity to meet him. Hi, John. Leslie Serpernot. Thank you. So on behalf of the estate of Anne LaBastille, I'm donating these grebe paintings. These were done by Guatemalan natives, and they belong in the lab. They don't belong in some box where I would be keeping them. So these are yours. And as well as stamps that were made from, not from those paintings, but from other paintings. So here are the commemorative stamps.
Next to the paintings, beautiful.
Yep, and here's a little blurb on what those stamps were, and you can still find
fantastic.
That. So.
Fantastic, thanks so much.
You're welcome. So, thank you. So, do you come up now? And I've got a gift for you. I have two signed copies of Jaguar Totem for the first two recipients of the scholarship.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for your presentation.
Yeah, you're welcome. Good. Thanks.
Well, that was just about wonderful. To bring us our evening service to a close here, I guess we should say thank you to all our guest speakers, especially to Leslie for coming a long way and being with us in this wonderful presentation today. So why don't we do that one more time?